Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back. I'm Alex. Let's hear from Arne Gunderson, who found the Japanese megacity of Tokyo is seriously radioactive. In case you forget, in this short clip from the NEIS conference in Chicago, Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com tells us tens of millions of people in Tokyo, Japan, are still irradiated every day from the Fukushima reactor accident there in 2011.
The authorities, whether IAEA or the Japanese government, have consistently underestimated the radiation. I was in Tokyo in February. I was on the book tour, and I brought plastic bags with me. And every day, I would walk outside and grab some dirt from where I was. And I ran. I came back with the dirt, brought them through customs officially. You know, you have to declare dirt when you bring it back, and then sent it to a lab. And all five bags would qualify as radioactive waste here in the country. And this was on the streets of Tokyo. So, you know, what we would have to ship to Texas and store by our standards in Tokyo was ubiquitous. I was there again in August, and I was over on Niigata, which is on the opposite coast on the Sea of Japan. And it didn't get nailed by the plume so much, but the mountains between Fukushima Prefecture and Niigata are contaminated. And now their sediment in their rivers is loaded with radiation as well. In addition to the exposure people are picking up with their handheld inspectors and, you know, the devices or Geiger counters that people have, there's also a lot of hot particle contamination where people have ingested the material. We have cases where we have house dust that we're getting. People are sending us vacuum cleaner bags of dust. And one of the bags, which was examined over in England, it was 100,000 disintegrations per second in a two-pound bag of dust. And that goes on, of course, for centuries. So the Japanese sleep on the floor. So the dust that's on the floor is in their lungs. And I am at the... Based on my experience at Three Mile Island, I think over the next 30 or 40 years, we could see a million cancers as a result. I understand that that's an extreme view. But when you look at Steve Wing's work at TMI, and I extrapolate linearly with that, I think we're going to see a lot of cancers. Right now, we see an enormous... In Fukushima Prefecture, 40% of the kids tested have thyroid nodules. The normal number is 1%. The thyroid nodules are a precursor for cancer. So we're at the beginning of that experience, and it's alienating women especially and causing Fukushima divorces. I could go on about this. We'll talk out in the hall.
That radiation will be in Japan for thousands of years, affecting the health of humans and all species for generation after generation. That's why we don't want any more nuclear power in America and Canada, Britain, Europe, China, Russia, India, or anywhere else. One panelist at the Chicago conference suggested, we have a good solution for nuclear waste, but no political will. Again, a person attending called out that statement. Well, what is this good solution? Name one. She couldn't. Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds, he's a realist. He says, well, we do have to deal with what we've got, and at the very least, get all those fuel rods out of the storage ponds right next to the reactors. If the power goes out on those cooling ponds, they can explode, as happened at reactors 3 and 4 at Fukushima, Japan. The spent fuel rod should be put into concrete casks as a much safer temporary solution on a priority basis. Get to it. But the first thing to do, Arne tells us, is simple. If you are in a hole, stop digging. And this comes from a past nuclear executive in the field, Arne. He says there are no safe solutions for the waste problem, so we need to shut them down, instead of continuing on the suicidal path of creating still more radioactive waste. My special thanks to the Nuclear Information and Resource Service at NIRS.org and Dale Lehman at WZRD Chicago for this heads up on nuclear waste developments in the States. Find more links at the NIRS website or in my blog at ecoshock.info for both the audio and video of the whole conference. It was held in Chicago December 1st and 2nd, and it was titled Mountain of Waste, 70 Years High, Ending the Nuclear Age. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
How do you describe the world that we're leaving to our kids that will be much hotter, much more threadbare, as far as you can think? I mean, if that doesn't engage emotion, then nothing does.
Because New Orleans became the first climate refugees in the continental United States.
If everybody did this in the United States, we would sequester all the carbon that's been emitted since the beginning of the industrial age in less than 10 years.
So the choice is, should I stay in this paradigm that's collapsing and falling apart and isn't fun anyway, or should I be engaged in something that's thriving, something where we have futures for our children?
What if you could spend a year on the road visiting all the cool projects in America? You'd interview the big names and cover the big cities trying to become more sustainable, but you'd also hunt down those interesting folks socked away in the back roads with unique projects that really work. Save your gas money and the greenhouse gas emissions. Now it's been done. You can go on a voyage discovering that unknown country, the really smart America, with a new film. It's called YERT, Y-E-R-T, standing for Your Environmental Road Trip. The movie producer is Mark Dixon. A co-conspirator and YERT tripper is Julie Dingman Evans. Our guest is her husband and the film's director, Ben Evans. Ben, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Good to be here.
Well, Ben, why don't you just introduce our listeners to the general idea behind YERT?
Yeah, well, all three of us in our own ways got really concerned about where the world was headed back in 2006. It had been building for a while, but it reached a breaking point for us personally. And so we decided that we were going to go really put our lives on hold and go explore the country for a year, every state in the country and America, the U.S., that is, and try to find sustainable solutions. We knew they were out there, but we knew that there was a lot that wasn't getting covered and wasn't getting seen by people. And we wanted to go find sort of the best sustainable solutions out there that are really tackling the pretty heavy challenges that are facing us. And so it was a mission of hope with a little bit of humor along the way, and we wanted to find the solutions that are out there and also make ourselves part of the experiment. So we gave ourselves a little challenges along the way to try to be a little greener as we traveled.
And this film is loaded. We have lots to talk about. I'd like to list out a bunch of the famous names you interviewed, but the real stars for me are all the creative people I would never have known about. Who are some of those lesser-known cool people who inspired you?
Well, one of our favorite stories is a 92-year-old caveman in Idaho named Dugout Dick. He'd been living there for about 60 years, literally in a cave in Idaho. He went there as a miner back in like the 30s or 40s and realized it was warmer in the cave than it was in his pup tent in the mountains of Idaho. And so he started living in the cave and then started digging out other caves in the side of this mountain. And a whole cave community kind of sprung up there. And he was living a sort of remarkably low-carbon lifestyle, almost zero carbon, really. Perhaps had the lowest ecological footprint of anybody we saw the entire year. You know, and he's 92 years old when we met him. He was one of those interesting stories. We were at a restaurant in Rhode Island, and it was our last day in Rhode Island, and this was a couple states before Idaho, and we there were other people in the restaurant, and they saw our yurt mobile parked outside, and they said, "Hey, are you yurt?" And we said, "Yeah." And we came over and explained what we were doing to this other table, and one of the people jumped up and said, "Oh my gosh, you got to follow me!" And he hopped on his bicycle, and we followed him all around Providence, and finally back to his place. And he was building the super eco house, and he was actually buying up old decrepit apartment buildings in Providence and fixing them up, making them super green, and then flipping them. At the end of the interview, he said, "Hey, are you guys going to Idaho?" And we said, "Yeah, you know, we're going to every state." And so he said, "Well, when you go to Idaho, you got to go see Dugout Dick." And we said, "Well, yeah, who's Dugout Dick?" And he explained who Dugout Dick was. And once he explained it, we were like, "Yeah, we'll totally go see that guy." And he said, "Great, you can stay in my cave. It's two caves down from Dick's." and that was the kind of, you know, that was the kind of thing that we found on the road through just happenstance and dumb luck. We found that kind of thing all the time in a way that we never would have found if we had just been sort of researching online or not actually out there to see it. So he was a prime example of a lesser-known person who was doing something kind of odd and out there, but interesting in its own way.
Yeah, sort of a cave subdivision developing around him. But most of us are not ready for the cave situation. In fact, we're stuck in cities whether we like it or not. So you did find some cities that were making some serious efforts towards greening themselves up. Could you talk about one or two of those?
Sure. You know, Chicago was one of those that was really making a lot of strides when we visited. And in particular with green roofs. At the time, a guy named Sadhu Johnston was their sustainability director, and they had, I think, 3.5 million square feet of green roofs going on at the time. I'm sure it's more now. And they were really being strategic about it. They were, looking at sort of the rainfall amounts and flood situation with paved roads and surfaces, and then figuring out where the best places to have green roofs were to mitigate some of the stormwater overflow and things like that. So they were sort of overlaying a bunch of this data on top of each other to really pinpoint what to do where to be as sustainable as possible. And that was really interesting. One of the other interesting sort of off the beaten path things that we found was the City Museum in St. Louis. And that was a museum made entirely out of junk, basically out of repurposed items. And this guy, Bob Cassley, was a sculptor, had bought this old shoe factory and then turned it into this museum. He started small, just sort of sculpting things out of junk and out of reclaimed materials. And eventually people got wind of it and started sending him stuff, 35,000 cafeteria trays that were left over or something like that. And so he would turn them into these works of art. So this museum became this sort of 10-story, constantly evolving work of art that's fully interactive. You go there as an adult and you turn into a 10-year-old kid and you're just, you're sliding down this 10-story spiral slide and you're climbing on this off the school bus on the roof. And it's really an incredible place and an incredible testament to what we can do with what's around us if we start to rethink the whole concept of waste. And so St. Louis is clearly doing something in the right direction about that. And there's really enough junk in almost any city in the United States for every city to have its own city museum. It just takes somebody to go ahead and do it.
Well, yeah, and we can even make homes out of recycled materials.
Right, yeah. Earthships in Taos, New Mexico, there's a guy, I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with Earthships, a guy named Michael Reynolds who's been he's been working on Earthships for 40 years now. Super, basically zero carbon housing that's made out of what would otherwise be considered garbage by a lot of people. Old, tires and bottles and cans. And he, figured out a way to basically take those materials and turn them into houses that heat and cool themselves. They generate all their own electricity. They capture and treat all their own water and deal with wastewater internally and grow food off of the wastewater. They're really just completely off the grid, incredible homes. They're sort of the ultimate green home because they're actually absorbing garbage. So they're not only, zero carbon, they're actually sort of a net positive on the planet by their very existence. And that's really inspiring, inspiring stuff.
Well, I think we're on to one of the key parts of this movie. You do interview experts on climate change and peak oil, but the whole time your team, Mark Dixon, you and Julie, seem intent on keeping every bit of waste you create in your car as you go along. It's like whatever you bring in, you have to keep. How did that work out?
Yeah. Well, it was a goal early on. We realized we were going to be making a little bit of a footprint just by virtue of having a road trip in the first place. And so we wanted to lower that as much as we could. And the idea of keeping all of our garbage with us came up and we decided to go for it. So we had to pace ourselves. We did a little pre-trip experiment and realized really quickly that we were in over our head if we didn't change some things. And so we decided to pace ourselves and tweak a little bit of our life habits. And so we only allowed ourselves one shoebox of trash and recyclables per month for all three of us total. Everything had to fit inside a little shoebox-sized container that we carried with us. And that allowed us to really kind of keep all of our garbage in the car with us for the entire year and recyclables. Because the car was packed extremely tightly when we left. It was packed to the gills with our equipment and our clothes. And, it's a year on the road, so we were packed to our eyeballs. And so we really had no idea how we were going to fit any garbage in there with us. It went really well. And then Julie, not to spoil the plot or anything, but Julie got pregnant about 3 months into the trip. And we have no idea how that happened. But that threw a wrench in the works. And then it became a bit more challenging to keep all of our garbage with us because she was starting to crave things that generally required garbage. Yogurt, for instance, was a good example. When you're on the road and somebody requires yogurt immediately, you pull over and you get yogurt. Otherwise, you pay the price. And so what do you do with these pint-sized yogurt containers. Luckily, we found a zoo later on our trip that actually uses those to feed their animals as is. And so the rule with us was if the object could be used in its present form, if it had as good or a higher use in its present form, then we were allowed to donate that to whatever cause that was. And in this case, it was feeding zoo animals. They would use those as feeding buckets for the animals. And so we donated like 30 yogurt containers to them, and that helped us out. But it was a challenge, but I think we pulled it off okay.
Well, I love the scene of trying to go through a fast food drive-through line there and getting them to put the food in your refillable containers rather than their usual wads of packaging. We could all do that. We should all do that and just take our thermos and cutlery wherever we go. What cities did you find were doing the best with recycling?
San Francisco, I think, is at the top of many people's lists for that. They have, you know, mandatory composting now. I mean, they've even improved by leaps and bounds since we finished the trip. But yeah, they have mandatory composting now. I know Seattle's got a great sort of citywide composting program as well. And of course, recycling is the first step in a lot of that. So that's a given at that point. Those cities are doing really wonderful work. You know, other cities that you would associate with these kinds of endeavors, like Portland, Oregon, and, you know, cities in the Midwest, like Boulder and Austin, things like that, or the West, I should say. And on the East Coast, you know, Burlington, Vermont is an extremely green city, among others. And then cities, you know, it was funny. We, like you said, we would go into restaurants and we'd bring our utensils with us, or we'd bring our reusable containers or whatever. And generally, the wait staff in most places that we ate were extremely supportive. That was kind of the first conversation we would always have when we got into a new place was with our server. We'd say, hey, look, you know, we had to be proactive. So we'd say, you know, we're doing this crazy experiment. Can you help us out? We're trying not to make any garbage. And they would jump right on board, and they'd go back and talk to their manager. And sometimes the manager would come out and say, hey, what are you doing? And then they'd realize, yeah, you know, we don't really need that little plastic ramekin or that doily or whatever. And they'd actually change restaurant policy sometimes based on the encounter. But one time in Nebraska, we ran into a waitress that just wanted nothing to do with our little experiment. And so she gave us a really hard time and said that it was against the law, what we were trying to do. And we said, against the law of Nebraska? And she said, no, against the law of this store. And that was really the only time where we met some resistance. And so we just ordered finger food and dodged that bullet. But by and large, people were really supportive. And I think recycling is one of those things that's catching on, and it's great that it's happening. I mean, the ultimate goal is to not generate the waste in the first place or the packaging in the first place. So it comes down to just, you know, buying less stuff and having more fun.
Well, this movie, you spend some time showing us dirt and manure and worms up close. That isn't usual Hollywood hit material. Is it that important?
Oh, yeah. It was. We had a great time digging into those issues. Soil is the key to life in a lot of ways. Wes Jackson, one of the people that we covered on the trip, really believes that if we're going to get a sustainable planet, it's going to happen through agriculture first. You know, we all eat three meals a day or more or less, and every meal is a vote for the kind of world we want. And he talks about this miraculous living skin on planet Earth, on this biosphere, and it really is kind of truly miraculous that we're lucky enough to have a living skin on our planet. That's really what it is. And so, you know, soil, good soil is the key to good food, and it's how we grow our food touches on so many issues. That, you know, it touches on water and transportation and fossil fuel usage and nutrition, everything. So digging in the dirt is a great way to literally get back to the land and get in touch with what it is that makes the planet tick. And so, yeah, we had a couple fun encounters, one in particular at Joel Salatin's farm in Virginia, literally digging in his pile of cow and pig manure and seeing how his pigs, you know, how he's using his pigs to basically do his dirty work and build, you know, build the soil for his farm, basically. And then another one in New Jersey with a company called TerraCycle. They sort of revolutionized the whole notion of worm poop, you know, and really brought it to the masses and revolutionized the whole concept of waste. And, you know, his goal, Tom Zaki's goal of TerraCycle is to, you know, eliminate the idea of waste. And so he's doing that through worm poop, converting food into worm poop, and then you know, that's the greatest fertilizer there is.
I agree. And you did mention that your team gives itself some survivor-like challenges to match. Could you tell us about just one?
Sure. Well, there was the garbage challenge. Certainly was that was throughout the entire trip, and that was a challenge to be sure. And then, you know, we also had a challenge that we established fairly early on. We would layer these challenges on as we went. So by the end of the trip, you know, we were doing the full array of challenges all on top of each other. And so the next one that we layered on after the garbage challenge was the challenge of lights, never turning on an incandescent light. And so that meant anytime we entered a room, we had to scope out the fixture, light fixtures first, before we knew whether or not we could turn on the lights. And so it meant a lot of time in the darkness in motels or wherever we were staying. And then we had these LED headlamps that we would wear sort of constantly. And so we got real good at just wearing those just about everywhere we went once it got, you know, once the sun set. We had an interesting time with a friend of ours in California that we stayed with. When we got there, we were fully enmeshed in the light challenge at that point. And we talked to him in advance. He called up ahead of time and said, "Hey, you know, what's the challenge you guys are doing?" And we explained the light challenge, and he's like, "Okay, I got it." So we showed up to his house. He had labeled all of the light switches in his house as to whether or not they were safe to turn on. And he'd actually gone and changed out a bunch of the lights in his house to CFLs or LEDs in advance of our arrival so that we could function in his house. But there were a few, you know, light switches that were verboten, and so he was careful to label those, and we thought that was really fun.
The light inspectors arrived.
Stop polluting the earth.
Get more hybrid cars.
Biodiesel cars.
Carrot juice.
We need a movement as morally urgent, as passionate, as willing to sacrifice as the civil rights movement was a generation ago. Nothing less will do.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the director of a new film, Your Environmental Road Trip, or YURT for short. The movie is peppered with snappy interviews with some famous movers and shakers. Ben Evans, would you care to drop a few names on us of people you talked with?
Well, gosh, you know, Wes Jackson is at the very top of that list. He was really an inspiration, and we ran into him about halfway through the trip, and he just blew our minds. We kind of thought we knew what was up, and then we talked to him for 2 hours in Kansas, and we realized we had a lot to learn, and so he really opened our eyes to a lot of issues. Bill McKibben is also another pillar of the film. He's doing some incredible work right now with 350.org, and they just finished their Do the Math tour, you know, trying to get colleges and universities specifically to divest from fossil fuel investments. And so that's really a critical work that he's doing. And then we had Janine Benyus, who's the sort of the godmother of biomimicry. And she was a wonderful interview and another outstanding human being. Will Allen, who's spearheading the urban agriculture movement, urban farming movement in Milwaukee with Growing Power. And his methodology is spreading like wildfire to cities all over the world now. And Joel Salatin, I mentioned earlier, he's the farmer from Omnivore's Dilemma. A lot of people know him from that book. And he was a wonderful host. He just opened up his farm to us, and we all had a great time together and learned about what truly sustainable farming is all about, and specifically raising livestock in mixed systems to really build soil and sequester a ton of carbon. One of my favorite stats from the film came from him, where he says, if everybody farmed like this, we would sequester all the carbon emitted since the beginning of the industrial age in less than 10 years. If everybody in the U.S. farmed that way. So it just speaks to the power of the soil to really lock up a lot of carbon if we're doing things right. Scott Broussard, who's starting to get a name for himself, he's the co-inventor, I should say, of an idea called solar roadways, which involves repaving all the roads in the United States with solar panels that you can actually drive on. So the road system replaces the power grid and replaces all the power supply, and there's a ton of other ancillary benefits, and it's a really powerful, huge idea. And so he was another interesting, starting to be a big name that we talked to.
Well, Ben Evans, this is one of the big messages I did get out of the YURT film. From these days, from bloggers to newspapers, it's all about how awful things are in America. Collapse is right around the corner. Americans suck. But this film shows just how dangerous it is to generalize about a few hundred million people. I want to abuse Ronald Reagan's slogan, it's like you found 1,000 points of light out there in the darkness. So after your big trip, how do you measure the doom meter versus the creative solvers you've found?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. It's a constantly evolving answer. You know, I think that the great thing from the trip was that we really did, like you said, meet thousands, literally, of people all over the country doing incredible work in the face of really long odds. And that was incredibly inspiring. One of the favorite things that we would hear from people time and again was, no amount of money would change what I'm doing. That was a sure sign that person was onto something. You know, they were living their life with a lot of integrity and a lot of joy, doing what they really believed was right. And so we found people like that all over the country. At the same time, there are, you know, the science gets more and more grim every week. It feels like every week there's a new headline about some tipping point that we're either passing or about to pass, or goals of the international community, keeping it up, you know, keeping the climate under a certain, you know, amount of degrees, 2 degrees C, or now it's getting pushed up to 4 degrees C because 2 degrees C doesn't look like it's possible. And that's daunting. That's really scary stuff. And so we didn't want to shy away from that. But at the same time, even somebody like Guy McPherson, who's perhaps my favorite person to go to for this kind of stuff, if you really want an unvarnished look at the potential future we're facing, even he says that to kind of throw up our hands and to say, well, we're toast, is kind of irresponsible, and it's really makes it a self-fulfilling prophecy. It guarantees failure. And so one of the questions that we asked throughout the year was, are we doomed? And that was a provocative question intentionally that we asked most of the people who we interviewed. And one of our favorite answers came from another one of our luminaries that we were lucky enough to talk to, David Orr. And he said, you know, it's almost the wrong question to ask, because if the answer comes back yes, well, then, you know, we all just cash in our chips and head to the bar and, you know, turn into a bunch of hedonists because, you know, everything's, you know, going to burn anyway. He says, if the answer comes back no, then that can breed complacency where, you know, oh, well, we're not doomed, so I can relax. And he says, the best spot to be is right in the middle. I don't know. You know, I don't know if we're doomed, but what I do know is that I'm going to roll up my sleeves and get to work. You know, the only thing I can do is live in the here and now and do the best I can and really try to work as hard as I can to make sure that my children have a future. And so that's what his message to us was. And I think that's what we take to heart, even though things look really grim. You know, life, this is another little quote from a recent Bioneers conference that just happened. Paul Hawkins said, you know, life is for life. And I think that's true. I think as human beings, we're on this earth ultimately to try to connect to the rest of life as deeply as we can. And that's true whether, you know, whether we're around for another year or another 1,000 years or 10,000 years, you know, that goal remains the same. And so the extent to which we can do that, I think then we're naturally, as Janine Benyus says, we're naturally creating conditions that are conducive to life, which is what life does.
Yeah, you do attack some heavy subjects in the film without blinking, and yet I did find myself laughing during the movie, so it seems like we're not going to get out of this without having some fun as well. Where is the Yurt film at now? How can my listeners see it or get a copy?
Sure. Well, as of December 11th, 2012, we are nationally distributed with first-run features, and so people can go to the Yurt website, which is yert.com. And there they can buy the film directly. They can set up a screening. We're doing college campus screenings all over the country and community screenings all over the world and screenings for businesses and community groups and on and on. And so that's really where people can find out more information about the film, order a screening, order the DVD. And the new DVD, the one that's out through First Run Features, has a bunch of really wonderful extras. We have deleted, you know, the usual deleted scenes and filmmaker commentary and some additional short films. We just weren't able to quite work them into the feature film, but there was this one story in particular that for me was perhaps the most inspiring story all year, and it's now its own short film, and it may even expand into something else down the road. But a lot of extra good stuff in the new DVD.
Okay, well, we're out of time. Our guest has been Ben Evans, along with his wife Julie Dingman Evans and producer Mark Dixon and Erica Bowman. They put out one of the best films of 2012. That's my opinion. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.